Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with my co-host Tim Henney. First today, we talk with Damian Eccles and Lori Davis. Theirs is a love story you, dare I say, need to hear directly from them to believe. Eccles is one of the West Memphis Three accused and convicted of murders he didn't commit. Davis falls in love with him while he's in prison and lobbies for his release. Their book, Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm Tim Henney. Our second guest is Dr. Catherine Beals, a sport nutritionist who focuses on eating disorders and nutrition needs of female and elite athletes.
This is The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW. We'll be right back.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Vinto is a proud sponsor of KPCW. Vinto offers wood-fired pizza and seasonal Italian cooking for lunch and dinner. Nestled at the bottom of Lower Main Street, Vinto is open year-round and now offers a summer menu with new seasonal appetizers, salads, sandwiches, pasta, pizza, and cocktails. More at vinto.com or 615-9990.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time InstaCare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza InstaCare, 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with Tim Henney. At the age of 18, our guest Damian Eccles was condemned to death as part of the Memphis Three for a crime he didn't commit. He spent 18 years on death row and was released in 2011. Our guest also is Lori Davis. She saw the documentary film Paradise Lost, about the biased nature of the trial and the charmingly tragic character at its center, and was compelled to write a letter to Damian. That was back in 1996. They fell in love. They were married in a Buddhist ceremony at Tucker Maximum Security Unit in Arkansas in 1999. In their book, Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row, they share the story of their relationship through love letters, postscripts, and footnotes. They say it's a story not unlike many others, just the circumstances are, well, extreme, to say the least. Here now to talk with us about life, love, and the magic are Damian Eccles and Lori Davis. Good morning, you two, and welcome to The Mountain Life.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Well, it's so nice to have you, and I think I want to start here with, you know, wanting you to run through for our listeners. I think we all have heard of the West Memphis Three, and maybe some of us have seen the four or five documentaries and know a little bit about it. But for those who don't, I wanted to ask you first to run through it really quickly. And as I was thinking about that question, I thought, wow, you have to relive this story every day of your lives.
Yes, I've been out for almost 3 years now, and I don't think a single day has passed in those 3 years that I haven't had to talk about it in one way or another. What it comes down to, I mean, if you just distilling the essence of the story, in 1993, three young boys were murdered in West Memphis, Arkansas. Me and two other guys were sent to prison. We were accused of being Satanists and of killing these boys as part of a human sacrifice. Eventually, as the years would pass, they did DNA testing on DNA that was found at the crime scene, and the DNA was shown to not only not match me or the other two men they had convicted, but instead it matched one of the victim's stepfathers. I was released from prison in 2011. All told, I spent 18 years and 76 days in prison, sentenced to death for something I didn't do.
And during that time in prison, you became, well, accomplished on a variety of levels. You've written books. You were considering a pious life for a while. But in 1996, when Paradise Lost, the first documentary about the story came out, Lori Davis, you saw this documentary one night, just happenstance, I think. And talk about what happened to you.
Yeah, I did. I saw it as part of a film festival here in New York, and I was deeply affected by it, as were most of the audience members. Seeing the movie, you can't help but know that there was a grave injustice that occurred in West Memphis at that time, in the community, in the case, and the horrible murders. But I'm from the South too, and I understood the culture. I was raised in a fundamentalist Baptist home, so I knew what Damien was up against. Certainly not to that degree, but I was always a bit of a rebel and a little bit of an outcast myself. And so I felt the need to reach out to him. I wanted to help him in some way, and that's what my first letter was—just an offer of my help.
So it was, you were so compelled, maybe more compelled than anything you've ever felt in your life. And I have to ask you, you know, was it equal parts for you, the falling in love with the idea of Damien's innocence, or falling in love with the man himself? I mean, he's pretty attractive and compelling himself.
He is. And actually, the case and the details of the case didn't come up in our first correspondence. It was all about him for me, and his mind, and his he's got an amazing mind and exciting. He even to the point that sometimes I would forget he was in prison, because he withheld a lot of information about the abuse he was suffering and his conditions. We kind of had this fantasy life of writing to each other and talking about ideas and art and literature and books and religion. So the first couple of years, I have to admit, I was a little naive. And of course, as life went on, it got a little more dire and a lot more difficult.
Lori, I'm really curious about that initial connection you felt with Damien after seeing the film, and why you were compelled to contact him and write that letter. Do you think there was an aspect of the forbidden love? I mean, Damien was unobtainable because of the circumstances. Did that draw you in any way, or was that not a part of what happened?
I don't really associate that. I don't think about that. I mean, I'd had, you know, normal relationships before in my life, and it's not something I would have ever wished for myself. I think that's kind of, you know, a brutal way to have a relationship. So I think, as I was saying, I was kind of pushing the reality of the situation away, and I was just caught up in this person and his mind and what we were doing, getting to know each other. And in the course of that, I fell in love with him, but no, I don't think it was anything that had to do with the forbidden, because that just doesn't seem very healthy to me.
And Damien, I'm curious about how the case stands currently. I know you mentioned that the DNA was connected to one of the boy's stepfathers. Has this been resolved, or are we still in an open case?
No. I mean, it's still what's eventually going to have to happen. Not only do we have the DNA evidence, but we also had three eyewitnesses who came forward and put the same person the DNA matched with all three of the victims within an hour of the time they were murdered, and the police and prosecutors still refused to do anything. Probably what's going to happen, you know, look at how long it took us to get this far. You know, just to get me out of prison, it took 18 years. So we're not naive enough to think it's going to happen overnight. Most people think the justice system, you know, based on shows they've seen like CSI or something, that everything is nice and tidily wrapped up in an hour. But in reality, it's grindingly slow. What will probably have to happen is all the people who have an interest in keeping this covered up, you know, the judge, the prosecutor, the attorney general, all of those people will probably have to move out of their current offices. They'll either have to retire or get voted out or whatever it is. And new people who don't have anything to lose will have to take over those offices before anything will ever actually be done.
And is that the, I mean, that you just kind of stated that they have a vested interest in keeping this as the status quo. And it's because it would not reflect well upon their performance in the past, putting you in jail,
absolutely.
Accusing the wrong people, not pursuing the evidence.
Well, you know, most people think, whenever they think of people like judges and attorney generals and prosecutors, they have this idea that these people are somehow moral, that they're protecting society. What they don't comprehend most of the time is that in reality, they're politicians. They're just like senators. They're just like congressmen. Their number one priority is always to win the next election. And they know if they have to come out and admit not only did they sentence an innocent man to death, but allowed a murderer to walk the streets for almost 20 years in the process, they're not going to win that next election. So they're going to do whatever it takes to keep that covered up, and justice will always take a back seat.
Damon, what happened to the other two boys that were sentenced with you who are now young men also? What was their story and where are they?
The guy who went to trial with me, Jason Baldwin, he now lives on the other side of the country in Seattle. He just got his degree. He wants to be able to graduate law school so that he can help people who are in the same situation that we were in.
And did he spend time in prison? Was he incarcerated and in jail?
Yes, he was sentenced to life without parole. He's out now. The other guy, he only had an IQ of somewhere between 68 and 70 to begin with. And then when you put all this trauma on top of that, they've pretty much made sure he will never, you know, live anything remotely resembling a normal life. The last I heard, he's living in the exact same trailer park in Arkansas he lived in when we were arrested. He's living with his dying father, and he doesn't have any contact with the outside world at all.
Hmm. Sorry if we jump around here a bit. The story is so fascinating that I want to go back to the case and then forward to your love story and then back and all over the place. But I think that's what makes it so interesting. So not only, Lori, were you very attracted and compelled by this case back in 1996 with Paradise Lost, but it also attracted other celebrities. One of those was Eddie Vedder, Natalie Maines, and then eventually Peter Jackson, who goes on to make West of Memphis, which I think premiered here at Sundance in Park City. Was it 2012 or 2013?
It actually premiered in 2012, yes.
Okay. Okay. So talk a little bit about all this celebrity connection and, Lori, how you hooked up with, you know, there are pictures of you and Eddie Vedder sitting next to each other fighting and lobbying for Damien's release.
Well, it all once again goes back to Paradise Lost, and most everyone, I believe, Eddie and Peter Jackson and his partner Fran Walsh and Johnny Depp, Natalie Maines, Henry Rollins, the list goes on. But most of them, almost all of them, saw Paradise Lost, and then Eddie was the first one to contact me, Pearl Jam, and the amazing thing about all of the celebrities that came on board, you know, they have a platform and they have resources, and a lot of celebrities get involved in causes. But instead of just putting their name out there and throwing money at it, they all got involved with us. We've known them now for over 12, 13 years, some of them, sometimes Eddie even longer. They became involved in the actual case. Educated themselves. They stayed involved. Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh actually became part of the legal team and provided the resources to hire investigators and advised on that. And it was amazing, the support. Johnny Depp did a 48 hours segment, which, you know, he doesn't have the time and energy to do TV shows.
Yet he did, and
they stayed close as friends. I mean, they were in constant contact with us and visited us, and so the support was, I couldn't have done it without them.
Our guests are Damien Eccles and Lori Davis. Their book, Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row. And I wonder, you know, the case still goes on a variety of levels, and I'm wondering about the continued involvement of people like Peter Jackson and Johnny Depp and Eddie Vedder. It goes on for those families who lost their young boys. It goes on for you, Damien, because to a certain degree, you're still fighting for your innocence, aren't you?
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's something that none of us, honestly, none of us have any closure on. You know, it's kind of telling that the only person involved in this case who has any sense of closure is the prosecutor. It's, you know, two out of three of the victims' families now are doing everything they can to have the case reopened, to have our names cleared, and have the person who actually murdered their family members put where they belong in prison. And that's one of the things that we have to keep doing. You know, this isn't pleasant. It's not fun. I always tell people, imagine the worst thing that's ever happened to you in your life and then having to talk about it over and over and over every single day. You get to the point sometimes where you just want to scream in frustration. But at the same time, we know that the reason I'm alive right now is because the rest of the world was paying attention to what the authorities were doing in Arkansas. If not for the rest of the world paying attention, they would have murdered me. And we know we have to keep that attention on them if we ever want our names cleared, if we want the person responsible in prison, and we want the authorities who did this to us held responsible for what they've done. We have to keep doing it.
Right. And I just want to make the note that you were forced to plead guilty and to vow to not press charges against the state in order to secure your own release. So that's why you're still fighting to clear your name,
yeah.
Right?
It's a very odd thing. It's not even a complete guilty plea. At first, they offered us a guilty plea, and I said, no, I'm not taking it. I'm not saying I've done something I haven't done. So then what they agreed on was, it's called an Alford plea. It's very rare. What an Alford plea means is you get to legally maintain your innocence while at the same time accepting a guilty plea. It makes no sense whatsoever. And the entire reason that this plea exists is so that the state can't be held responsible for what they've done. To this day now, the state of Arkansas has never had an exoneration. They still say they have never, in the entire history of the state, sent an innocent person to prison.
Wow.
Damien and Lori, have you used your notoriety and platform to expand out and away from your own specific cause and broadened it out to people who are, you know, convicted of crimes that they haven't done and are on death row? This was something that hit the headlines a few years ago because I think at Northwestern there's a group of attorneys who have taken up this cause. Have you gotten involved in that on more of a national level?
We do constantly. That's pretty much what we do all the time now. We travel and we speak to law schools, criminal justice classes, future criminal journalism students, things like that. That's pretty much what we do all the time. And one of the reasons is, you know, in one way we're speaking about my case and my situation specifically, but at the same time, it's like hopefully an educational process so that every single person who hears us speak about this, that hears us speak about the system and what went wrong and everything else, we know those people are potential jury members on someone else's trial in the future and can help make sure the same thing doesn't happen to someone else.
Lori, you and Damien have used a term, the magic, and you spell it M-A-G-I-C-K instead of magic. And I'm curious how that relates to our, as humans, relationship with relationship. You two found something which you call magic, which allowed you to connect when you weren't able to connect physically, when you were separated by these extreme circumstances over an incredibly long period of time. And yet we have, you say it's typical or common of what happens in a lot of people's relationships and marriages. And yet in a lot of those situations, people have physical proximity and they can be intimate, and yet they lose the connection. How were you able to capture that connection and nurture it into what you have today?
I think that's a very good question, and I think that's one of the main reasons that I wanted to put this book out. I think the most important thing you can do in a relationship is communicate and find new ways to communicate and connect with each other, and Damien and I were forced to do that, whether it was writing letters or talking on the phone, sometimes we would read the same book so that we could talk about it and get each other's perspectives, or we would watch the same movies. Sometimes we would meditate at the same time every day, and we did visualization practices, and we share a spiritual practice. And even to this day, we try to continually, we still talk a great deal, we communicate all the time, but I think that was forged in that need to create these connections with each other. And I think it's the most important thing we as humans can do with anyone that we love.
Many of us are guilty of coming up with a fairy tale ideal of someone who's out there who we assign all these attributes and characteristics to, and then we fall in love with that vision, which may or may not have anything to do with reality. But it seems like you guys did that in the beginning, perhaps. At least Lori, you did. Damien, it was really great to have her loving you as you're sitting in prison. But talk about that, because now you're married and you're still going strong.
I think that's when you don't know someone, and you're getting to know someone, you do have, idealize them, I think. And sometimes that goes horribly wrong, as we all know in relationships. You get to know, and you keep hoping that they're going to come through, and they don't. Well, Damien just kept coming through for me. He still does today, but that's not to say that there weren't times that we just couldn't stand each other. And that also happens, and I think it comes down to making the decision, or knowing deep inside yourself, are these really hard times worth it? Is my life, is being with this person worth going through this? And if you can always answer yes to that, then you should stay with that person. And I think that's what it comes down to. And that's not ideal. I don't think anyone ever stands up to the other person's ideal, right? I just don't think that happens. But it's surprising what you can discover if you can get through those hard, bleak times with someone, because it always turns into something else.
Lori,
we've been together for 18 years now, and we've been through some excruciating times and also some extremely joyous times.
Wow. Okay, quick question, because you have another interview to get to, but did you ever feel petty for, asking Damien to meet your emotional needs when he's sitting there on death row? That must have been challenging.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But that didn't stop me from doing it.
Right. Well, what an amazing story. There are so many elements to it. Damien Eccles and Lori Davis, thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you for having us.
Bye.
Again, the book is Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row. Wow. Stay with us. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Kevin Stocking, president of Heber Valley Bank. We offer a full spectrum of loans for lots, construction, HELOCs, commercial, and personal needs. Our loan decisions are made locally. Heber Valley Bank is a proud supporter of KPCW. We are located in Heber City and Midway, and at Grand Valley Bank in Park City. HeberValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Big air, big skills, big fun. Catch the Flying Ace All-Star Freestyle Show this summer at the Utah Olympic Park. Every Sunday at 1 p.m., the All-Star athletes showcase spectacular aerial talent into the Olympic aerials pool. Watch as they soar up to 60 feet in the air, performing acrobatic feats. During the month of July, additional shows will be available every Saturday at 11 a.m. For show tickets and more, go to UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Damien Eccles and Lori Davis, their book Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row. Damien Eccles still, to some degree, fights for his innocence. He was one of the West Memphis Three, a fascinating story. Our next guest, Dr. Catherine Beals, has a PhD in exercise and wellness with an emphasis in human nutrition. She's an associate professor of nutrition at the University of Utah. Her areas of expertise include sport nutrition, nutritional biochemistry, macro and micronutrient metabolism, energy balance, obesity, and weight control. She focuses her work on the nutritional needs of female and elite athletes, where she often encounters eating disorders. We know Park City to be a town with a high level of awareness when it comes to our food, sport, and nutrition. And we're glad to welcome Kathy Beals to The Mountain Life to discuss these topics. Good morning to you, Kathy.
Hi, good morning.
It's nice to have you. Well, I have to say that Tim and I met you first on a bike ride, and we couldn't believe how you blew by us going up the hill. And and your story is really interesting to what you do as a profession, which is that you are an elite level master's athlete, a triathlete. So talk a little bit first about your sporting life.
My sporting life. I started actually as a distance runner. I was a distance runner in college. And I sort of got interested in nutrition because back in those days, the motto was lighter is faster. And so coaches, including my collegiate cross-country coach, really hammered it into our heads that we needed to be light. I've always been small, so it was never really an issue for me, but I saw many of my teammates struggle with trying to lose weight, developing eating disorders, and that's kind of where my interest got sparked. And then I was sidetracked a little bit. My undergraduate degree is actually in political science, so I was on a path to be a lawyer. And thankfully, that didn't work out. So I got a master's in exercise science and did some work in the fitness field and then went back for a PhD in nutrition. And that's when I was able to really sort of realize my interest in working with athletes and eating disorders and nutritional needs and that type of thing. I continue to train and sporadically through various different degrees. And then once I got out and got established, I started competing a little bit and was successful. So continued.
Successful to the degree that you are nationally ranked.
Yes.
Yes, as an age group triathlete,
as an old athlete. Yes,
you're not really very old. But do they call it age group or do they call it masters?
Well, I believe it's more age group. So masters can vary depending on which type of sport you're doing. Sometimes it's over 40. If you're talking about masters in swimming, it's anything after college,
which seems so unfair.
I know, that's totally so. So it really depends. But so I would say it's more of an age group thing. Yeah.
Kathy, has the science of nutrition changed so dramatically from when I was a kid in high school? In the 1970s, we had double sessions in the heat of the Midwest during football. We weren't allowed to drink water during, the morning session, only in between when we were done. So there was no water on the field. There was no Gatorade. Gatorade hadn't been invented. There was no nutrition. We had a session in the morning. We went home for lunch. Everybody passed out, basically, at the water cooler. And then you had a session in the afternoon when you had recovered and put fluids back in your system. And to me, I'm just sort of shocked by that. But the other part of it is maybe our food was so different then that we didn't, there's two components. Maybe the food was whole enough and full enough of nutrients that we were getting what we needed, even though we weren't getting the water and the things during the workout. Or has the science of nutrition changed that much that we just now know that we were idiots then and we're so much better off now?
I think it's the second one. So yeah. I think that the science of nutrition has, I don't know if I would say it has changed so much, but it has really come of age. And, back when you and I were athletes at the collegiate level, the focus was really on the physical training, and nutrition was very much secondary. And I think the focus has shifted somewhat. Maybe I would even argue sometimes too much to the other end, where people think nutrition will cure everything. But I think that we know a lot more now. There's been a lot more research examining the role of that nutrition plays in not only training, but the actual performance. And so our knowledge has increased, and that knowledge has been translated to the field. So we know now that restricting fluid from any sort of athlete, whether it be as a form of punishment, which sometimes would be the case, I know in football, or whether there was some concern that it would, you know, cause cramps or what have you. I mean, we know that's not true. And so now fluid is provided on the field. Electrolytes are provided in the proper ratio. So we just have a lot more knowledge, and we're actually applying that knowledge.
Was there any particular sport that kind of pushed the envelope on these issues, or was it just sport in general? Because I'm wondering if, you know, I mean, Gatorade came about because some coach on the Florida State football, or the Gators, I guess it was the Gators.
The Gators,
yeah. Said, hey, you know, if we can get some nutrition in these guys, maybe they'll play a little better, duh.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if there was a sport that kind of pushed the whole concept of sport nutrition, maybe triathlon, because they've been focused on that for a long time, although it's a relatively new sport.
I, you know, speaking to the history of it's probably not my expertise. However, I think football, absolutely, because it's a very visible sport, and certainly there's a lot of money in football. So obviously there's going to be the motivation to improve the performance of the athletes. I think that's probably where part of it started. As endurance events became more popular, obviously those are the athletes that are going to have the greatest nutritional needs. So, of course, there'd be a lot of focus on research in the area of endurance athletes. And I think what you see now, even more so, is specialization. So there is not one size fits all for sports nutrition when it comes to athletes. An endurance athlete is going to need a very different nutritional regimen than a strength or resistance trained athlete or a power athlete like a football player. And even within the endurance athletes, a runner is going to need something different than a swimmer, than a triathlete, than a cyclist. So it's really become more specialized.
I'm thinking back to Mark Allen and Dave Scott, and when they – it seemed like, you know, those guys didn't have the backing. They didn't have coaches. They didn't have teams. They didn't have money. They were doing it, you know, because they wanted to get faster and beat one another almost. It was that competition between the two of them that – almost, that kind of compelled them to explore outside the norm. And when Dave Scott started, it was just who could go longest, furthest, be strongest, last the longest. And then Mark Allen kind of brings all these other elements into it, sort of that Zen approach to triathlon and endurance participation. And I think those guys kind of pushed because not because they had the backing, but because totally self-focused and motivated.
Right, right. Interestingly enough, I did my undergraduate degree at UC Davis, and Davis, California is where Dave Scott came from. So I remember Dave Scott in the early, early days before he was really well known. And he would show up to master swim practice every once in a while, and we'd all swoon because Dave Scott was there. But sort of to answer your question, I think that, yeah, they didn't know a lot back then. But one of the things you have to keep in mind, too, is that, and I always say this even to my students, great athletes are born. Nutrition, physical training obviously can sort of push them from great to excellent. But, you know, Dave Scott has a genetic makeup that not many people have. So, you know, nutrition certainly is going to help foster that. But if he didn't have the genetic makeup, the fact that he rinsed his cottage cheese to, you know, for whatever reason he did that, that wasn't really what improved his performance. So.
Well, and it's interesting because we do like to hear from, you know, celebrity athletes or just athletes around here. Of course, we have many world-class athletes in this town, and we want to know, well, what is it that you do that's going to also give me the edge? But as you say, it's, yeah, the genetics that we don't have. But wanted to ask you then, specifically, you mentioned a moment ago about endurance athletes needing different nutrition. Just off, you know, off the cuff, say an endurance cyclist versus an endurance runner? How would you, just a couple of items, nutrition items, what would you say?
Well, they're both endurance athletes, so getting adequate calories to support their training is going to be similar between the two, right? They both need to make sure that they're meeting their energy requirements. So, and obviously, since they're expending so many calories in training, whether they're cycling or running, they're going to have a higher energy requirement than somebody who's not doing an endurance event. Other than that, again, the macronutrient distribution, carbohydrate, protein, and fat will be pretty similar for the cyclist and a runner. The difference would really come in how they fuel during their training, with a cyclist likely being out on the road for several hours, 3, 4, maybe even 5 hours, whereas a distance runner, even on their longest run, might only be out for an hour and a half to 2 hours. So fueling before, during, and after the event would probably be what would distinguish the cyclist from the runner.
Okay. And that fueling after the event, it seems like maybe around 10 or 15 years ago, this recovery really came into play. Is it still, do we need to still pay as much attention to it? And what does recovery, good recovery, look like now?
Yeah. So that a lot of that depends on what the actual training bout was, or if it was a competition, what that looked like, how long was it, how intense was it. And then the other key factor is going to be how soon until you have your next training bout or your next competition. So, yes, the notion of recovery sort of took on a life of its own. I can remember, initially it was you needed to make sure that you consumed carbohydrate and protein within 2 hours. And then it was 1 hour. And then it was 30 minutes. Yeah. And then it was as soon as possible. And if you don't do this, you won't recover and you're likely to get injury. It was horrible. The research now pretty much shows that if you have more than 8 hours before your next training bout. So let's say I'm more of a recreational athlete and I train once a day. If you have 8 hours before your next training bout, don't worry about it. Huh. Eat your next meal when you're going to eat your next meal. Make sure you're getting adequate total carbohydrate throughout the day to replenish glycogen stores and don't stress over it. If you are an athlete such as a triathlete who often does double workouts in a day, so there is less than 8 hours, then you want to start eating some carbohydrate with a little bit of protein, generally within about 30 minutes. And that amount, again, will depend on not only what your first training bout looked like, but what your second one's going to look like. But on average, we generally say, if you can get somewhere around 1 to 1.2 grams per kilogram of body weight every couple of hours for 4 hours, a little bit of protein, maybe 10 to 20 grams, you're good to go for the next training
bout.
So
carbohydrate replaces the glycogen. Protein repairs the muscle.
Yes, although, in terms of muscle repair, it's not going to happen before the next training bout. So generally when we talk about adding some protein in, when we're trying to replenish glycogen stores quickly, one of the things that protein will do is it stimulates insulin production, and that insulin helps with glycogen resynthesis. Oh. I can go into more detail if you want. Otherwise, we can just keep it simple with that.
That's fascinating, though.
So a little bit of protein. And you also have to think about the fact that, it's going to be more palatable. People get sort of hung up on what macronutrient. And, the reality is we want to eat a mixed meal. To sit down and eat nothing but carbohydrate won't be very palatable and be pretty boring, and it'll be hard to sort of pick out. So a mixed meal with a little bit of carbohydrate, a little bit of protein, small amount of fat, that's what you need.
Is there an importance to the type of carbohydrate? I mean, I know sugars. There's all sorts of different sugars we get. And when you talk about calories equal energy and you made that connection, we have to put enough calories in to get our energy. And a lot of that comes from carbohydrate. But isn't there kind of a good carbohydrate and a less good carbohydrate?
I'm so glad you asked this question. No.
Oh, carbs are carbs are carbs. Yeah.
That should take on a whole new life of its own here, I think. But, I think this notion of good carbs, bad carbs, it has been blown out of proportion. Huh. You know, and I love it when people say, well, I don't eat sugar. And then I'll say, well, do you eat fruit? Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, fruit contains sugar.
Right.
Well, that's natural sugar. Well, you know what? Sugar is sugar. If you look at it molecularly and chemically, it's sugar. It's glucose and fructose. It's the same thing as table sugar. The difference is the package. So if I eat a jelly bean, okay, there's nothing else in that jelly bean but glucose and fructose. Okay. If I eat an apple, the predominant carbohydrates in there are glucose and fructose, just like the jelly bean. But the apple also has fiber. It comes with some water. There's a few vitamins and minerals. So it's the packaging. There is a time and a place for nothing but glucose and fructose. When I'm out, you know, doing a 2-hour run, I don't want a lot of fiber. So eating an apple, aside from the fact it might be sort of difficult to eat that apple while I'm running, I've got fiber, which contributes no calories. It does contribute bulk, so it might actually cause me GI distress while I'm running. Instead, I want something that's basically glucose and fructose. So jelly beans, and in fact, you know, Jelly Belly would say sport beans are the way to go. Those would be a good type of carbohydrate. So this good and bad, it's taken on a life of its own that I think has sort of lost meaning.
And what about the mix? Because I mean, I'll personally, from my perspective, I love protein, and that's what I fuel with a much higher component of protein all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And my approach, whether it's right or wrong, is the carbohydrates kind of take care of themselves, because in eating, in life, there's a lot of opportunity to consume carbohydrate.
Mm-hmm.
And I have more of a craving, a natural craving for protein, which is kind of nice because it just swings me over there. And then I find that I just perform and fuel better with protein. Is that typical or is that unusual? Or is everybody a little different and they have to find how they match?
I would say that everybody is individual in terms of their nutritional needs. That's what makes it fun, I think, working with athletes, because you know, no athlete is the same as another. And that's why I say, even with endurance athletes, you take two different runners, their nutritional needs will be a little bit different. And part of it will be their likes and dislikes, as well as, you know, what works best for their body. I think in general, endurance athletes often skimp on protein because they're so focused on carbohydrate and fueling. So it's the endurance athletes, actually the cyclists and the runners, where I often see inadequate protein intakes. So getting a little more protein probably wouldn't be it.
You think there's a genetic component to coming from Australia? Because again, in back in the old triathlon days, I don't know if you remember the guy Greg Welsh and his wife Sean, after every, you know, major Ironman competition where they came in the top three, they consume beer as their recovery drink. I mean, then, you know, right there, they just start the party
right there.
Yeah. It's like, I thought it was kind of an Australian thing.
Carbos.
I mean, you'd have these other guys going, oh, you got to recover and drink this and drink that. And these guys are tapping the keg.
Yeah. Well, I would say that it's probably okay, because if they just finished an Ironman, they're likely not to be training in the next eight hours. But yeah, beer is not the best recovery for a hydration standpoint, because alcohol does tend to interfere with fluid retention. So yeah, if you're trying to rehydrate, probably, especially if you have something coming up later, if that's your last training bout for the next 8 hours, not a problem.
Yeah.
Speaking of fluids, water, you know, it's all so specialized is what you're saying, and we have individual needs. It seems to me that some people need more hydration than others. So that's a question. And also water in general, you know, we're supposed to have 8 ounces. We're supposed to have a gallon. Well, it doesn't really matter. Just drink when you're thirsty. What's the skinny on water?
Okay. So, So this notion of eight glasses of water per day actually came, there is a scientific rationale for it. So if you look at, you know, baseline fluid losses, on average, people lose about 2,000 to 2,400 milliliters of fluid per day. And when
that's
you
how much when you're talking ounces.
Oh, gosh. Well, 240 milliliters is 8 fluid ounces. So,
And how many milliliters?
About 2,000 to 2,400.
Wow.
Yeah.
So like 4 cups of fluid?
Well, if you think about it, what we lose is about 8 cups of fluid per day. So that's sort of where the notion came from, is that that's what we need to replace. But you have to keep in mind that we get fluid in our diets not just through drinking water, but drinking other kinds of things, whether it be dairy products like milk or juices. If we eat fruit or vegetables, those are very high in water content. You know, they don't call it watermelon for nothing. So, you know, it's we get fluid in our food. So to obsess about, do I need to get 8 glasses of water per day? No. You need to replace what you lose. So if you consider that on average, without any fluid loss through exercise like sweating, just through normal urination and breathing, we lose about the average of about 8 cups of fluid per day. So we need to replace that somehow, whether it be through food or fluid. Now you add on exercise, and then you've got additional fluid loss with sweat. And, of course, every time we breathe, we lose some fluid in our breath. And the more we breathe, we're going to lose more fluid. So as we exercise and our respiratory rate goes up, we're losing more fluid. When we come to altitude, like at Park City, our respiratory rate goes up, right? Less oxygen, we lose more fluid. So you need a little more fluid when you're in altitude. The rule of thumb now is there is no set amount that you should be drinking when you exercise. You want to replace what you've lost. People say, well, how do I know how much I've lost? Mm-hmm. You weigh yourself before and after exercise, and the amount of fluid that you've lost will show up on the scale. If you didn't lose anything, then you can figure the amount of fluid that you consumed during your exercise bout was about what you needed. Mm. Figure out how much that was, and that's what you should replace.
Hmm, that's good.
So this notion that thirst is a poor indicator of fluid needs, I don't know where that came from, because it actually is.
Right.
If you ask anybody, I do this in my classes all the time, I say, how do you know you're thirsty? They all say, dry mouth. It's actually a very good indicator of fluid requirement. We tend to override it sometimes, but if you pay attention to it, it's a good indication.
Right. Our guest is Dr. Kathy Beals. She is a professor of nutrition at the University of Utah and also an elite level athlete. I want to ask you about eating disorders. And, you know, I think with the whole Lance Armstrong thing coming back and all these books, Tyler Hamilton's The Secret Race, we've learned a lot about how endurance cyclists starve themselves, and they're to a certain degree dealing with probably eating disorders. They certainly look anorexic a lot of times. But so talk about that. Is it still light is faster?
I think in some sports that is the case. There still is this belief that lighter is faster. I think that you know, years ago when I first started having an interest in the area, eating disorders weren't talked about much, especially among male athletes, and certainly, you know, not among female athletes, but it was very taboo among male athletes. I think that they have sort of come out of the closet, so to speak, as more and more elite athletes come forward indicating that they've struggled with disordered eating. You know, Dara Torres, the list of female elite swimmers can go on and on, female elite gymnasts, and some distance runners as well. So I think, and even some triathletes. So, you know, I think that it is not as much taboo, and so we're learning a little bit more about it. I think there still is the notion among endurance athletes that lighter is faster, and probably no place more than in cycling, because your climbers will tell you that if they have less weight on their frame, they can climb faster. So we do see it in cyclists. Interestingly, you ask about that, because that's sort of where my research focus has shifted the last few years, to looking at cyclists and disordered eating and bone density. And we found some pretty alarming statistics. The last study that I did examined elite male cyclists, Cat 1, Cat 2, cyclists here in Utah. And of the cyclists that I tested, 90% of them had osteopenia, which is low bone density. And of those, almost half had osteoporosis. And these were all cyclists under the age of 40. So,
did you compare that against another group of non-elite, or how would you what's the control group?
Yeah, sedentary, I would say lightly active sedentary males. I'm just finishing up data collection on male swimmers, so I'm going to compare the swimmers to the cyclists, and I don't have that data yet.
And what do you think the data suggests? I mean, so you're finding this condition. Mm-hmm. How do you think they get to that condition?
They're not eating. So I think they,
Will they admit to that when you do collect the data? I mean, are they saying, I don't eat as well as I should? Or
yes, yes. They're restricting their energy intake in the hopes of weight loss. And that restriction in energy intake is negatively affecting their bones. We didn't really do a lot of testing for overt eating disorders in these individuals. And my hunch is that I guess I have to sort of step back. And eating disorders are psychological disorders. And so they're played out through a restriction of food in the case of anorexia, or binging and purging in the case of bulimia. My hunch with the cyclists is that there's not a psychological issue there. It's really more just an extreme dieting for weight loss so that they can try and improve their performance.
Do you think there's a way to accomplish both? I mean, they're exerting themselves at such a level that the weight's got to drop off anyway. So they're burning so many calories that they're achieving it that way. Would there be a way to shift the mix so that they would be able to eat a lesser amount of some better mix that would give them – that wouldn't result in the condition that they're yes. getting with their bone density?
Absolutely. I think a lot of athletes don't understand the nuances of nutrition. And I think if they had some appropriate nutritional counseling, that they could eat appropriately – for maintaining, a lean body mass that will help improve performance, drop some of the fat mass, and not be starving themselves and not negatively affect their bone density. But oftentimes, athletes like the general public turn to inappropriate sources for their nutritional information, whether it be from, nutritionists or their friends or magazines or things that I think are inaccurate and could be harmful.
All very interesting. Well, Dr. Kathy Beals, thank you so much for joining us today. We're out of time, but quickly tell us what your next competition is.
I have done 3 competitions already this year, and I'm sort of taking a little break. I've taken up mountain biking, and I'm really starting to get an interest in that. So I think my next thing is going to be trying to do an Xterra race. Not sure when.
Oh, great.
Once I get the mountain biking to a point where I feel really confident.
Nice. Well, I hear there's a great one up in Ogden.
That's what I hear, too.
So, great. Well, we want to thank you for joining us today. It's Dr. Kathy Beals from the University of Utah. Also want to thank Damian Eccles and Lori Davis, our guests, Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row. And thank our underwriters.
The Park City Clinic, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Grand Valley Bank and Heber Valley Bank, Park Meadows Country Club, and Vinto Pizzeria.
And stay tuned but tune in again tomorrow for Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. We'll speak with Alex Bellow about the wild, wacky, and wonderful world of math, and also Graham Simpson. He has a wonderful book about how even a scientist with Asperger's can find love. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peek here with Tim Henney. Of course, you can always access archived shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab. And Mountain Life, it's time now for NPR News. You're listening to KPCW Park City.